Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Katie Weaver, and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, attempting to open very old books and records without damaging them can be difficult. But scientists in Switzerland say they have improved a method to read age-old documents without even touching them. Researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology are using radiation in the form of X-rays to create images of the documents. This method is called X-ray computed tomography, or X-ray tomography. On a recent day, the researchers used X-ray tomography to read from a small 14th century document. Giorgio Margaritondo is working on the project. Reading from the document, he noted, "In the year 1351, a young lady from Venice wrote a testament, and then the testament was sealed, and remained sealed for all these many centuries." Italian officials are planning to use X-ray tomography to build an open digital system in the state archives of Venice. Margaritondo says, "What you find inside the archives are not only small documents, but most of the items are huge volumes the size of a table, and so we must be able in the future to look inside them. Many of the documents show signs of weathering and are easily broken." Fazia Albertine is also working on the project. She says, "We need a non-invasive technique to read inside them. Thanks to the use for thousands of years of iron-based inks, we can read them using X-rays." Albertine is also with the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. The researchers have a lot of work to keep them busy. The State Archives of Venice has a huge number of records. They were produced over a period of about 1,000 years. The documents cover about 80 kilometers of shelf space.
Americans are still talking about a decision by the government to overturn its policy of net neutrality. The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, voted to end rules meant to prevent telecommunications companies from blocking or slowing the operation of some websites. Observers say the decision may lead to a trade war with Chinese telecom and internet companies, some of which are interested in reaching the U.S. market. China has banned hundreds of websites and never believed in net neutrality. The FCC ruling will free American telecom service providers to charge different prices for different products or services. Those providers will even be able to examine the data of their customers.
Many Americans dislike the loss of net neutrality and the idea that telecoms can watch them. But experts say the situation in the U.S. is far different from the realities facing Chinese consumers. In China, the government is monitoring and controlling telecom networks, whereas in the U.S., it is, at least so far, it is telecommunication companies, said Aija Liponen. Liponen is a professor at Cornell University's Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. She added that the U.S. government does not have the ability to control internet content. The FCC decision could help U.S. telecom service providers offer high-priced services, since those who pay more would get a stronger signal.
But this would also enable U.S. service providers to raise rates for foreign customers. Under net neutrality, foreign companies can easily access the U.S. market without facing the kind of resistance American companies are facing in China. Benjamin Cavender is with the Shanghai-based China Market Research Group. He thinks the FCC decision could have an effect on Chinese technology companies that want to do business in the United States. You are asking about companies like Alibaba or Tencent, what this means for them in the U.S. markets, and I could very possibly see this being used as a trade war tool. He also said that the U.S. government could force Chinese companies to pay a lot more to American internet service providers.
U.S. telecom companies are working with, or in some cases, becoming content providers by creating television shows, films, or websites to advertise products. Cavender thinks those companies might look at foreign players as competition. He said they could block large Chinese internet companies in an effort to force China to open its market to American companies. They just get completely blocked because of the U.S. using this more as a trade tool, trying to get more access to the Chinese market. Because if you are a U.S. technology company, you are working at a great disadvantage in the Chinese market. I do see this being used as a trade tool, Cavender said. The end of net neutrality means that American companies can say to China, "Let us in to your market, or we will block you from ours." While the United States has avoided such behavior in the past, observers say the situation may be changing during the presidency of Donald Trump. "I could see that happening," Cavender said. Even democracies are beginning to think about the need to regulate content. So the Chinese, you know, might take a little comfort in that, noted James Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. When you look at Europeans talking about blocking each other's content, when you look at the U.S. talking about blocking Russian political warfare, the internet cannot be the Wild West that it's been for a couple of decades, he added. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Scientists recently announced the discovery of a small, bird-like dinosaur from China, which had unusual, colorful feathers. The scientists named the dinosaur Zaihong, the Mandarin word for rainbow. They discovered the nearly complete and almost entirely undamaged fossil in Hebei province. Microscopic structures in the fossil suggest that the creature had wide, shiny feathers. The feathers mostly covered the dinosaur's head and upper body. The colors of those feathers would have appeared to change depending on how the light hit them. The colorful dinosaur lived 161 million years ago during the Jurassic period of Earth's history. Chad Eliason is an evolutionary biologist with the Field Museum in Chicago, Illinois. He helped write the study announcing the discovery in the scientific publication Nature Communications. Eliason told the Reuters News Service that the discovery suggests a more colorful Jurassic world than we previously imagined. The scientists used powerful microscopes to identify the remains of the cell structures responsible for the apparent color of the feathers. The shape of those structures appears to have influenced what color the feathers would have. Round-shaped structures in the Zaihong fossil show that it had feathers similar to that of a modern-day hummingbird. Much of Zaihong's body had dark feathers. The shiny, color-changing feathers covered its head and neck. The dinosaur had many bird-like qualities, but researchers doubt that it could actually fly. Its feathers could have served the purpose of gaining the attention of sexual partners while also providing protection from heat and cold. Zaihong was two-legged and had a long, narrow head with sharp teeth. It had bony crests above its eyes, and it hunted other, smaller animals for food. Scientists say many dinosaurs had feathers. Birds evolved from small feathered dinosaurs near the end of the Jurassic period. Zaihong had two kinds of feathers. It also is the earliest known creature with feathers that did not have the same shape on both sides. This is a physical quality that modern birds have and use to direct themselves while flying. The unevenly shaped feathers on Zaihong were on its tail. This suggests that tail feathers, not arm feathers, were first used to improve movement through the air in flying dinosaurs, scientists said. Xing Shu is a paleontologist with the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Xing Shu said, "It is extremely similar to some early birds, such as Archaeopteryx." Archaeopteryx is the earliest known bird. It is believed to have lived 150 million years ago. "To be honest, I am not sure what function the feathers have," Xing Shu added. "And I don't think that you can completely exclude the possibility that the feathers helped the animal to get in the air." The dinosaur's full scientific name is Zaihong Zhuqi, which means rainbow with a big crest. I'm Pete Musto.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Andrew Jackson was nearing the end of his presidency. He had served two terms. For many Americans, Jackson remained incredibly popular. They liked that a poor boy from the frontier who could barely read and write, grew up to become president. Historian Daniel Feller is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He calls the president and war hero the ultimate American self-made man.
He's a quintessentially American figure. You can't imagine anybody like this getting to be the head of a country at that time, certainly anywhere else but in the United States. And even in the United States, it would have been unheard of just a few years before.
Daniel Feller says Jackson often used government to help ordinary people instead of the rich and powerful. For this reason, many called him the people's president. But not everyone agreed. His opponents said, "Tyrants have always spoken in the name of the people." They said Jackson used his popularity to do whatever he wanted, whether it was legal or not. His opponents in Congress even denounced him with a censure resolution for not releasing some of his papers to the government. They called him King Andrew. Many American Indians called Jackson yet another name. They called him Jackson the Devil. Jackson wanted Native Americans in southern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, to move west. Jackson did not think it was right for Indian tribes to exist as independent nations within the United States. And white voters wanted Indians' land for farming. Historian Daniel Feller points out that the United States government had tried to get Indians to move away from white settlements for a long time, long before Jackson became president.
But Jackson brought an urgency to it that none of his predecessors had. Quincy Adams and Monroe had endeavored to remove Indians when Indians seemed to be willing to be removed. Jackson took the position that they need to be removed now.
In 1830, Jackson pushed a bill through Congress called the Indian Removal Act. The bill allowed him to create new Indian homelands in the Oklahoma Territory, an area west of the Mississippi River where few white Americans lived at the time. The federal government would essentially trade the Indians their old land for the new land and pay for tribes to move west permanently.
He managed to convince himself, and I think that's the best way to put it, that he was actually doing the Indians a favor, that Indian tribes that remained in proximity to whites simply disintegrated. Their tribal structure, their national structure disintegrated. They died.
Daniel Feller says just because Jackson believed he was helping the Indians did not mean he did not benefit from their removal or that he was right. Besides, the Indians did not have much choice. Jackson told them that if they did not accept his offer, their nations would be controlled by the American government. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creeks agreed under pressure. The Cherokees resisted. They even took their case to the Supreme Court, which agreed that the Indians were independent from state authority. But Jackson and the state of Georgia ignored the Supreme Court's decision. Eventually, soldiers forced the Cherokees from their homes and marched them over 1,600 kilometers to Oklahoma. More than 5,000 died. The forced march later became known as the Trail of Tears. Even the Indians who survived continued to suffer. The United States government did not meet the terms of the treaty. Few Indians were paid for their goods. Most were not given food and other supplies during the journey or when they arrived in Oklahoma. Daniel Feller notes that the United States has a long history of defaulting on its treaties with Indian nations, both before and after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson might not have intended for the Indians to suffer so much, but he did not lead his government to respect and protect them either.
There are many who regard Jackson as being the kind of epitome, the exemplar, the personification of everything that has been wrong, not only regrettable, but perhaps evil, in white America's treatment of the Indians.
Daniel Feller says Jackson's treatment of the Native Americans, along with some of his other actions, complicates his image as an American hero.
If you look at Jackson's own personal rise, it's a pretty impressive rise. It leaves a lot of dead people and a lot of displaced or abused populations behind it, including Indians, including slaves, including personally the people he shot. So, again, it's a complicated image. It shows this American character in both, you might say, its best and its most disturbing light at the same time.
In 1836, the American public voted for their next president. Andrew Jackson had served for 8 years. He did not want another term. He supported his vice president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had been very close to the outgoing president. In the election of 1828, Van Buren had been successful in forming a strong political alliance. This alliance helped put Jackson in the White House. Jackson was grateful for Van Buren's help and asked him to come to Washington to serve as Secretary of State. Van Buren quickly became the most powerful man in Jackson's cabinet. He was able to help Jackson in negotiations with Britain and France. But his greatest help was in building a strong political party for Jackson. Van Buren built up the Democratic Party by removing people from government jobs if they had not supported Jackson. These jobs were then given to those who had supported the president. Ultimately, it was the Democratic Party that gave Jackson wide support for his policies. Van Buren served as Jackson's Secretary of State for 2 years. By this time, Jackson had decided that Van Buren would be the best man to follow him as president. Jackson offered to resign after the 1832 elections and give Van Buren the job of president. Van Buren rejected the offer. He said he wanted to be elected by the people, but he agreed to be Jackson's vice president in 1832. 4 years later, at Jackson's request, the Democrats chose Van Buren to be their presidential candidate. Several candidates from the newly formed Whig Party opposed him, but the Whigs were divided, and Van Buren easily won the election. March 4, 1837 was a bright, cold day. The winter sun shone over the crowd that had gathered in Washington to watch the swearing-in of the new president.
Andrew Jackson left the White House in the presidential carriage, riding beside Martin Van Buren. It was the first time a president and a president-elect rode to the Capitol together for the inauguration. The big crowd on the east side of the Capitol grew quiet when Jackson and Van Buren walked up the steps of the building. After Chief Justice Roger Taney swore in President Van Buren, the new president gave his inaugural speech. Then Andrew Jackson started slowly down the steps. A mighty cheer burst from the crowd. "For once," wrote Senator Thomas Hart Benton, an ally of Jackson, "the rising sun was eclipsed by the setting sun." The day after Van Buren became president, Jackson met with a few of his friends. Frank Blair, the editor of Jackson's newspaper, was one of them. Senator Benton was another. It was a warm, friendly meeting. They thought back over Jackson's years in the White House and talked about what had been done. Jackson said he thought his best piece of work was getting rid of the Bank of the United States. He said he had saved the people from a monopoly of a few rich men. Someone asked about Texas. Jackson said he was not worried about Texas. That problem would solve itself, he said. Did he have any regrets about anything? "Only two," said Jackson. "I regret I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun." The next morning, March 6th, Jackson left Washington to return to his home in Tennessee. Jackson was to leave the Capitol by train. Thousands of people lined the streets to the train station, waiting for a last look at their president. Jackson stood in the open air on the rear platform of the train. His hat was off, and the wind blew through his long white hair. The locomotive bell rang, there was a hiss of steam, and the train began to move. Jackson bowed. One man who was there said it was as if a bright star had gone out of the sky. Jackson lived for 8 more years. He read as many as 20 different newspapers, exchanged letters with many people in government, and spent time with his son and grandchildren. But Jackson's health had never been very good. He had been shot many years before, and the gunshot wounds created problems. Andrew Jackson died at home on June 8, 1845. He was 78 years old. Back in Washington, Martin Van Buren continued Jackson's legacy by carrying out many of his policies. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.